Yeah, they're walking through the grain field, and they're picking some grain and eating it, and of course it's Jesus' disciples, but they're clearly targeting, you know, how can you let your disciples do this is really what they're implying. You're at fault in some way. And again, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record that story, and in fact, that happens just before the man with the withered hand, and so Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three, put the plucking of the grain, where the authorities are complaining about the disciples working on the Sabbath, and then immediately following that is a story of Jesus healing a man on the Sabbath day. And so you get this discussion about the meaning or purpose of the Sabbath. So we'll look particularly at the first three of these miracles as supplementary stories about Sabbath healings, draw some of the lessons we can about these Sabbath healings, and that'll provide some of the background for looking at John 5 and 9 next week, where we won't focus so much on the Sabbath aspect of it as the miracles themselves and what John is doing with those. You may notice that with both of those miracles in John, I put John chapter 5 as a scripture reference, but also in chapter 7, and then John chapter 9, but also chapter 10 and chapter 11, because with these two miracles, months and months later, a year and a half later, people are still talking about that miracle. And that just shows the impact that it had. And so when you get to chapter 7, people are still talking about the fact that Jesus healed that man on the Sabbath day back in chapter 5. And in chapter 10 and chapter 11, they're still talking about Jesus healed this man who had been born blind. And so, again, that was still obviously on their mind as well. So we'll consider that. All right, Luke chapter 14. And it came about when Jesus went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees on the Sabbath to eat bread, that they were watching him closely. You're going to see if he eats properly, I guess, or holds his teacup just right, or whatever. Well, clearly they're trying to entrap him in some way. And there in front of him was a certain man suffering from dropsy. And again, this water retention and swelling. And Jesus answered and spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they kept silent. And he took hold of him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, "Which one of you shall have a son or an ox fall into a well and will not immediately pull him out on a Sabbath day?" And they could make no reply to this. And, of course, the reason they couldn't answer is because there appears to be a pretty good body of literature. Now, of course, all of this comes from about 200 years after the time of Jesus, but most scholars believe that the tradition goes back much more anciently, and they were known for debating these kind of things, and they had concluded that the Sabbath, it was not God's intention by the rule of the Sabbath to be cruel to animals, and that, you know, if one fell in a well or something, you just had to let it die. And of course, for most of the people in that day, that would have been a significant, you know, financial adversity. That'd be like, you know, you lose your car or your house or something. I mean, it could be very significant. And so they said, yes, you know, the principle of mercy, compassion, rescue a person or even a dumb animal. Now, in that, they did conclude that if it was a Gentile that fell into the well, well, you can leave him, you know. a common experience was, you know, buildings falling on top of people, you know, a lot of earthquakes, things like that, and not the most structurally sound building. So if a house collapsed on top of somebody, you know, can you dig them out on the Sabbath day? And the rabbi said, well, you know, of course you can, you know, that's the right thing to do. But what if you don't know whether he's a Jew or a Gentile, you know, because screams of Jews and Gentiles sound very much the same. Well, you dig until you find out, you know, and you find out he's a Gentile, you leave him there and come back tomorrow. That just says something a little bit about Jews and Gentiles more than the Sabbath, perhaps. But that's some of the Sabbath kind of thinking or rules and regulations you get an insight to. So Jesus turns the tables on them, and there's this well-established precedent of showing mercy. Now, obviously, did the rabbis talk a lot about healings that take place on the Sabbath? No, that wasn't an issue. They didn't have miracle workers going around on the Sabbath healing people. That's not something they had discussed, you know. And so, it's not like they had specifically ruled on this, but Jesus is able to point to the principle. If you can get your kid out of a well or an ox out of a well, how much more so a person who's sick out of this, physical catastrophe? It's just the same kind of thing. If a person had the capability to heal them, so is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? And so they just couldn't respond to his argument here. So that's part of the picture. Anything anyone wants to add to that, or any other points to make, Shane?
Well, it's just interesting. I mean, Jesus was the only person that could heal, period. So, the fact of whether it was lawful or not, they couldn't even perform it if it wasn't the Sabbath day.
Right. And we're going to see when we get to chapter 13, back a chapter earlier than this, a similar kind of thing. The ruler of the synagogue is going to say, there's 6 days upon which you should come and get miraculous healing, but not on the Sabbath day. Well, you just think how absurd that is. You're admitting a miracle has happened, and you would think in the background would be, this must be the work of God. So God doesn't have a problem with it happening on the Sabbath day, so why should I, But here he is quibbling about it because, he's attacking Jesus. And that's what happens a lot of times when we just want to attack somebody. We lose our mind and do things without really thinking through, perhaps, like we should. All right, the man with the withered hand, you're going to see is very similar to this. Let's look at the version in Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3. And this is one of my favorite stories. Now again, at the end of chapter 2, they were going through the grain field, and the Pharisees were saying, see here, why are they doing what's not lawful on the Sabbath? And he responds here, have you never read what David did when he was in need and became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar, the high priest, and ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for anyone to eat except the priests, and he gave it also to those who were with him. And he was saying to them, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Consequently, Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath. And I mainly read that to set the stage for the Sabbath healing now in chapter 3. And also we see some of the arguments that Jesus makes about the Sabbath. And we're going to come back to that a little bit later here and kind of catalog these different arguments that Jesus makes. And he entered again into a synagogue, and a man was there with a withered hand. He's kind of the opposite of the man with edema, His hand's all swelled up, and this guy's hand's all withered down to nothing. And they were watching him, just like in Luke 14. They're just sitting there, just expecting something going to happen, to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath in order that they might accuse him. Now, this tells you, of course, that they know enough about Jesus already that, you don't sit there. I'm not sitting here watching you to see whether you're going to heal somebody. I have no expectation anyone here is going to do that. But that something gave them the idea that Jesus just might up and heal somebody. And here's a candidate who comes into the synagogue. Is Jesus going to heal this person? And so they know something about Jesus and his reputation for healing, the possibility, maybe even likelihood that he might do that, and they're going to watch him carefully to see if he does. And he said to the man with the withered hand, rise and come forward. And you can just picture these people, we didn't wait in vain. Here it comes. Get your video cameras rolling here. We're going to get the goods on him. We're going to have evidence that he's going to violate the Sabbath. And he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to kill? Same thing as in Luke 14, and same response, stony silence. They can't answer that because anyone in their right mind knows the answer to that question. There's no way they could answer that without contradicting themselves. And after looking around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and immediately began taking counsel with the Herodians against him as to how they might kill him. Well, it's bad enough that the Pharisees and the Herodians joined together. I mean, they're like, that's like the NAACP and the Ku Klux Klan, you know, getting together. You know, people that are the opposite ends of the spectrum here, but they've got a common enemy, you know. And so the Pharisees and the Herodians, they just bicker and fight about everything, but they can agree on Jesus and how we need to get rid of him. It'd be kind of interesting to know what in the world the Herodians really had against Jesus. But, I mean, we know enough about the Pharisees and so on to see why they would be displeased. And they are so upset by what Jesus has done, they decide he ought to die, you know. And so that's kind of the beginning of the end for Jesus here, in a sense. That's a foreshadowing of course, the success they will finally have eventually, of course, at the end of the gospel. But here is the most amazing thing to me about this is, let's suppose, I don't know whether they were hoping for some kind of mob action, let's just jump on him in the middle of the night in a dark alley and get rid of him, or thinking of some trial, some kangaroo court, you know, like they wind up having before his crucifixion. But if this were to go to a court of trial, you could just picture calling these witnesses. Okay, we accuse Jesus of violating the Sabbath. Okay, what did he do? Well, you there's only two things you could say. Either he healed this guy, which would be an admission that he healed, right? But that would seem to, well, okay, by what power does he heal? You know, I guess then he'd maybe try to argue it's by demonic power or something, but, you know, presumably he'd be healing by the power of God. When if God's, again, fine with that, then how can you object to him healing on the Sabbath day? But let's look at it even a little bit more closely than that. What proof do you have that he's healed this man? Yeah, he said, stick your hand out. So we're going to convict Jesus of telling somebody to stick their hand out. Is that a violation of the Sabbath? No. You can say the word, stick your hand out, on the Sabbath day without breaking the Sabbath. And when the man does, his hand's healed. It's not as if Jesus, you know, spit on the ground and made some mud poultice and applied it to the man's hand and waved his hand and said abracadabra and all this stuff. Then you might have some evidence that, oh, he did all this work, you know, to heal this man and violated the Sabbath. But all he did was say, stick your hand out, as far as what the text says. And so again, it's just they know he healed this man, even though there's no evidence that he did. Just the fact he spoke to the man, and the man, when he obeyed, his hand was healed. They knew good and well who'd done that. But again, how do you prove it without your own guilty conscience convicting you that you know for a fact this is what this man has done? And instead of glorifying God, you're so put out with him, you want to kill him. But that's a very common response, you know, when you can't answer an argument, kill the person, you know. I mean, it's like Joshua and Caleb, you know, two spies out of the 12 saying, let's just trust the Lord and everything will be all right. And the whole nation of Israel had decided, no, we're not going to do that. Well, why can't they just leave, oh, Joshua and Caleb, they're just a couple of kooks, don't pay any attention to them. No, let's kill them. We need to stone them. Why? Because they're going to get their way? No. Because they're influencing the nation to do something different? No. It's just they're pricking your guilty conscience. You know they're right, deep on some level. So let's kill him. And that'll take away the pain of our conscience, you see. And it's the same kind of thing here. We just can't stand. We can't face up to the truth of what Jesus represents. And so let's kill him, you know, and get him out of the way. Charlie?
Or are they just that blinded in that hatred?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the miracles we know about that are performed in the Bible are from bona fide prophets. And the part of the problem is, you know, I think a lot of times people think in Bible times there was a miracle a day or something. And it's actually miracles were quite rare. And you do find them concentrated at certain time periods, like when God came to bring the Israelites out of Egypt and into the Promised Land, you get a cluster of a lot of miraculous activity. And in the time of Elijah and Elisha, you get another cluster of it. But these other time periods that go by where there's no evidence that miraculous activity is happening, and so it just may not have been that common. But I do think the Bible envisions the possibility that someone could do something miraculous, or at least appear to, and it not be truly from God. So, you know, like Deuteronomy chapter 13, a person predicts the future and it comes true. I don't know that it's simply addressing someone guesses and happens to get right once in a while. It may be from demonic forces or something. I mean, we know that that girl in Acts chapter 16 was foretelling the future of people because she was possessed of a demon. And now the text doesn't come out and explicitly say she was actually, you know, predicting the real future, but they were making a lot of money off of her, and I think the natural reading is that she was legitimate because she had this evil spirit in her. So it could be that some deeds like that could be caused, presumably by, you know, other spirits or something. And of course, the test that you're supposed to apply in a case like that is what they're teaching consistent with, you know, what God's previously revealed. So the guy that predicts the future and it comes true, but he teaches you to follow other gods that you've not known, you don't listen to him. And then I guess that would direct you to listen to the teaching of Jesus, and is it correct or not, you know? And that's part of, I think, what we see here. Is it proper to do good on the Sabbath, you know? Or, well, he's not here to harm. He's not here to do evil. He's here to do good. And so what's your criticism? What's your complaint? And it implies, again, a vast misunderstanding of what the Sabbath day is all about. It's not about harm. It's not about death. It is about good. It is about life. And his healing is consistent with that. And so there really is no basis upon which people should object to what he's doing. So good point. Anyone else have a observation or something?
Just along those lines. I mean, even if you had a shallow understanding of the Sabbath day, which is this is the day when I don't work and maybe I'm more devoted to God, then you should understand that there's a principle of relief. That 6 days I work and I have this day of relief. And these people are experiencing that relief when Jesus comes to heal them.
Right.
They should have said, wow, this fits in with the picture of what God made the Sabbath for.
Right. And I guess another way of looking at that is, you know, when you categorize the activity of Jesus' healing, is it more work or, like you're saying, relief, you know? I mean, just how much work is it for Jesus to heal these people? I mean, he really had to do nothing more than speak, and, you know, people were healed, you know? Sometimes he'd touch or sometimes, you know, spit and that kind of thing. But, I mean, how much of that's really work, you know?
There could be several reasons why they wanted to get rid of Jesus, because he said he was the Son of God, and also Caiaphas was a prophet. It's expedient for one man to die so the Romans don't come and wipe us out.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, and a lot of evil mischief afoot, that's for sure. Well, one last passage let's look at, Luke chapter 13, and this really illustrates the principle that Adam was talking about a moment ago. Luke chapter 13, this crippled woman who's just bent over completely double and can't stand up straight. Luke chapter 13, beginning in verse 10, Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. And, of course, one of these things about these Sabbath healings, too, you will see this in John 5 and 9. How long had the blind man been blind? Yeah, his whole life. Now, we don't know exactly how old he was, but he was an adult. And the man at the pool had been lame for 38 years, you know. So, and here this woman's been over for 18 years. you know, any of these people, couldn't they have waited one more day? You know, I mean, if you've been sick for 18 years, I mean, if Jesus waited one more day to avoid any trouble, that wouldn't be that big a deal. I mean, if you asked them, oh, you've been sick for 40 years almost, I'll come back tomorrow and heal you if that's all right. Great. You know, go right ahead. But Jesus intentionally heals these people on the Sabbath day in order to make trouble, so to speak. He's trying to make a point to these people. And so we ought to remember that. So he was teaching again in the synagogue. So again, he's not doing this in a back alley somewhere. You know, hey, meet me on, you know, the alley back of Main Street on the Sabbath, and I'll heal you then, you know. But he's right there in the synagogue. And behold, there was a woman who for 18 years had a sickness caused by a spirit. And so she's got this demonic possession that makes her crippled. And she was bent double, could not straighten up at all. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said to her, woman, you're freed from your sickness. And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made erect again and began glorifying God. And the synagogue official, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, began saying to the multitude in response, there are 6 days in which work should be done. Therefore, come during them and get healed, not on the Sabbath day. And the Lord answered him and said, you hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the stall and lead him away to water him? So here it's not even an issue of him falling in a ditch or some kind of emergency, urgent situation. It's just basic, you know, dumb animal doesn't know it's the Sabbath. And he eats and needs to drink, you know. And so you do that. And this woman, a daughter of Abraham as she is, whom Satan has bound for 18 long years, should she not have been released from this bond on the Sabbath day? And as he said this, all his opponents were being humiliated, and the entire multitude was rejoicing over all the glorious things being done by him. So, you know, Jesus just comes out and says, if there's any day this woman should be healed on, it's the Sabbath. You know, the synagogue official is saying any day but the Sabbath. And Jesus is saying only on the Sabbath is it appropriate to heal this woman. That's a good point, you know, just how much effort did it take Jesus to heal these people versus rescuing an ox out of a ditch or a well or something like that. And it kind of reminds me that really their whole understanding of the Sabbath was what was flawed. All the little rules and regulations they come up with were just kind of silly. But the root problem was they're just missing. I mean, a woman could not even look in a mirror on the Sabbath day because she might see a gray hair, and if she does, she can't help but pull it out. And that would be working on the Sabbath, you know. You can't throw a rock because it might hit a dog and he barks and drives sheep, and that would be doing the work of shepherding. And you can't carry a burden on the Sabbath. Well, how big's a burden? And so they decided a half of a dried fig did not count as a burden, but a whole dried fig did, you know. Well, what if you had two halves of dried figs? Do you put them together to make one dried fig and that's a burden, or are they two non-burdens and so you can carry as many half-dried figs as you want? And it just, you know, you think angels dancing on a head of a pin, silly. A lot of these Sabbath rules and regulations are silly like that. Now,
well, the Pharisees particularly, they made a law within the law which was more restrictive than the law.
Right. And didn't understand the law at all. And that's Jesus' point here. Is they had so perverted the meaning of the Sabbath, they were clueless as to what God was really after here.
I find it strange that the synagogue official is indignant with Jesus healing on the Sabbath, and yet he starts speaking to the people about coming to be healed on the Sabbath.
Well, come and be healed not on the Sabbath, I think is...
Well, he's getting on to them before it. Right?
The question, why is he getting on to them?
Oh, getting on to them for coming.
Not really any work on
their part. Okay. Well... I didn't know that. I personally didn't take it that he was getting onto them for coming and being healed, but that's the only time it should be happening, and maybe they're complicit in this man's crime of breaking the Sabbath if they allow that to be done to him or something like that. Now the meaning of the Sabbath. If you ask 100 people, 99 people are going to say the meaning of the Sabbath is what?
Rest.
Which is not a wrong answer, but it's not an entirely correct answer. Yeah, and you remember in Exodus chapter 20, when God gave the Sabbath regulation as part of the Ten Commandments, it's because God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days and rested on the seventh. But in Deuteronomy chapter 5, when God gives the Ten Commandments there, the reason he gives for keeping the Sabbath day is because I delivered you out of Egyptian bondage. And so the idea of deliverance is part of the Sabbath day too. And really you put those two things together to have the full picture of what the Sabbath is. It's deliverance out of bondage into rest. And now you can see why Jesus says what he does. This woman has been in bondage by Satan. I have now freed her from this bondage. What day is best for that? Let me see. What day means deliverance from bondage into rest? Oh, that is the Sabbath day. And so he actually understands the true meaning of the Sabbath and is enacting that lesson in this miracle. And of course, the miracle is not pointing to, I've come to deliver all of you from physical bondage into physical rest, but he has come to deliver us from spiritual bondage into spiritual rest. And that's what the Sabbath day was pointing to. It's what the Sabbath miracles point to. And so that's kind of what's in the background. That's the added element that comes through with these different Sabbath, you know, healings that happen. So we don't have a lot of time, but I'll just quickly catalog the arguments that Jesus makes. Using his own statements, man was not made for the Sabbath was made for man, and he's Lord of the Sabbath. And that kind of breaks it into three categories. So you have those arguments about mercy, see, that the Sabbath was not intended to hurt man, that God wasn't trying to be, not compassionate, you know, toward man's needs and so on. He wasn't trying to make a law that got in the way of man. And so Matthew chapter 12 and verse 7, Jesus quotes Hosea 6 and verse 6, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And so it may not be the strict keeping of the Sabbath day, but you have to, you know, I don't know, bend the rules a little bit. As needed for mercy. I mean, it'd be just like if, you know, you see someone who's fallen down and in great need, you know, on the other side of the street, but the pedestrian sign says, you know, don't walk. And, you know, you stand there because, well, you know, the sign says I can't, you know, go across the street, you know. Well, what do you do? Just let that person lay there and suffer and not help them because, you know, the sign says I can't, you know, cross. No, in emergency situations, you know, you ignore the sign and you cross. Now, if a cop comes along, you know, hey, if he's an idiot and he wants to give you a ticket, you just bear the price of jaywalking to do what was necessary to be done. You know, but we understand this principle too, and that's what Jesus was getting at. The argument of David and the showbread, David and his men were on the run and they were hungry. And hungry doesn't mean they didn't miss a meal. They were truly starving. And so it's an act of mercy, you know, on their behalf. Matthew chapter 12, verse 11, the illustration there is getting a sheep out of a pit. We read the one in Luke 14, getting a son or an ox out of the well. So showing mercy to an animal or a person. Luke 13, we read, you take the ox or the donkey to water it. So even just basic compassion like that. We also read doing harm versus doing good, killing versus saving, which is the describing that principle in clear terms. The second category is the fact that there are some things that are more important than other things. Really, the first one is an example of this. Mercy is more important than some rules and regulations that get in the way of mercy. And it's not God's intention that any law interferes with love and mercy, because love is the great commandment, and all laws are an attempt to give the content of love. And so if in some particular circumstance that's the opposite result, then that law has to be set aside in favor of the greater law, so to speak. And so there's a greater work that the Sabbath is here to serve the needs of man, not the other way around. And so priests offer sacrifice on the Sabbath day, because the sacrifice they offer is more important than this one priest resting on the Sabbath. You circumcise a person on the Sabbath day. That's a one-time thing in his life rather than resting on that particular Sabbath. Again, David and the showbread could be put in that category. But then the greatest of all is Jesus. He's greater than the temple. He is from God. He fulfills the true meaning of the Sabbath. And then, as we'll see in John chapter 5, the greatest claim he makes of all is in answer to this criticism he healed on the Sabbath on that occasion. And he says in verse 17, God works on the Sabbath day. And it's an implicit claim to deity, as we'll see. But we'll have to save that for next week. So be thinking about that. Again, read John chapter 5, chapter 9, and we'll consider that in the next week.